morning. I am so delighted, like out of my skull delighted to be with you. Advent, welcoming the God who draws near. Like, there's nothing better. To be with an auditorium full of women who love the Lord, who want to receive him, who want to be closer. One rule, every classroom has a rule. Our rule is, if you cannot hear me, it's okay to raise your hand. I'll get the signal. So please do. Please feel free. And can I share with you how it works? Okay, so my intention is not to teach you. It's not what we're here for. And I learned this lesson about 5 years ago. I got a phone call from a very close friend of ours who lives very close to us, so that she's part of the family, and she's in charge of a very large, prestigious, international organization. And she had prepared a year in advance for their speaker, and 3 or 4 days previous to this event, the speaker was named a bishop, and he had to go to Rome. So that left her high and dry. And she called, she said, would you mind stepping in? And these are all big people, like they all got their doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, cardinals. The Pope wasn't there, but the rest of them were all there. And then so I tentatively said, do they know who was supposed to come? And she said, So I went to the chapel, and I said, of course, I'm not gonna leave her high and dry. I'll do my best I can, but. So I went to the chapel, and I was really kind of at stroke level. I was just like the Lord took me to the high dive, and then gave me a little push, is the way that I was thinking. And as I sat there alone, it was quiet, the chapel was quiet. I was sitting there for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and I felt the presence of a feminine face right here that came right close to my face on my right-hand side. And I thought, what is that? And then I thought, no, you know what it is? I bet you this is a remembrance that's tucked back in one of the folds of my brain of my probably a first grade teacher, where I was getting nervous because I didn't know how to write whatever she was wanting me to trace. And the teacher leaned forward and gave me words of encouragement. I thought, oh. It wasn't until I was praying the morning that I was trying to pull myself out of the electric chair and get into the car and go, that I understood what that feminine face was. Because I heard the words, all you have to do is pour the water. It was Our Lady. Our Lady had asked Jesus, they have no more wine. And then I'm the little servant, that's all I am. I'm the little serving girl that gets the jug and fills up the water. It's Jesus between my words in your heart. He not only makes the best wine, he knows what is the best wine for your heart on this day. And the best wine that he gives us isn't like ordinary wine, where we can feel warm, or we can feel relaxed, or we can feel a little bit more upbeat, or we can feel a little looser with, you know, normal wine. But what I'm learning is the wine that he gives, if I will receive it, works to some lasting effect in who I am. It actually changes, it matures, it broadens, it expands, it tenderizes, it strengthens. His wine, because it's his blood, has a very real transformation, transformative capacity to change us. The one thing we have to remember is that he will never force it on us. I know because I fought him for years. It just doesn't work. But he's patient. And when we say yes, when we receive what he wants to give, life changes radically. So I'm not teaching, I'm just facilitating an encounter with you and the living God. And he will work. He doesn't ignore any of us. He doesn't bypass any of us. Let me get this out of the plastic. Let me start with something that's very, very fundamental. It's a story of when I learned something that changed my life. I remember very distinctly, I was probably 15 years old, I came bombing into the kitchen from school, really rattled. And I said, "Mom, Michelle's parents are getting a divorce." And she looked heartbroken, like, "Oh, sweetheart, I'm so sorry to hear that." And it's like, that response was not strong enough for me. Like, this was, like, I said, "Mom, they can't do that. They've been married for 20 years. That's as impossible as you and Dad getting a divorce." And I remember my mom looking at me going, "I wonder where she came from." Because there was a pause, and she said, "I am so sad that this has happened to Michelle and her parents, because it's affecting your best friend." I said, "But it's as impossible as you and Dad." I repeated it. And she said, "Sweetheart, it's not impossible that your father and I could get a divorce." I went, "What?" And she said, "We're not conjoined twins. We are two separate people. Your father and I have made the commitment that we will work things through day by day. We will love each other. But that's our choice and it's our daily commitment." It was very disorienting, like my world just got flipped upside down. This would have been in the very early 60s when divorce was not common. And if there was a divorce, nobody talked about it. It wasn't on the news and it wasn't on your Instagram and you didn't have this knowledge. So I was rattled for a couple of days, like the possibility. My father was an owner-operator of his own trucking firm. My brothers were in it too. So very often his hours were, you know, he wasn't a 9-to-5 job. And this had been my whole life, and I never worried about it. But now all of a sudden, I was worried about it. So where's Dad? "Well, honey, he's probably got a late load. He'll be home soon." My mind going, "Oh yeah? I wonder if he stopped someplace." Like all of a sudden this new world of intrigue. And I noticed, like, my mom always had the dinner ready. She put it in the warmer and she would go sit on the couch and knit. We had her first grandbaby was coming along, so she would be knitting for the baby. And she was really peaceful. I thought, "I don't think she should be that peaceful." And so a little while later, I go, "Mom, he's not home yet." And she said, "Well, why are you so concerned?" Well, because, "Oh, I'm not concerned." And it took me about the second or third day when I noticed her peacefulness and her unconcern. "He'll be home soon." When he gets home, we'll have dinner. Dinner's ready. It'll be fine. The truth that my mother could be in peace was grounded in her knowledge of my father's heart. She knew the man. She knew his core. She knew his heart. And she knew that his heart was with her, so she could rest in security. This is an essential message that surfaces all the way through the liturgical season. You and I belong. God has given his heart to us. Yes, my mom and I waited until my dad got home. We waited many nights. We all wait. There's no one in this room that isn't waiting for something. A breakthrough with one of our grandchildren. We're waiting for them to wake up and see how good God is. Waiting for people to understand how much they are loved. Waiting for peace in our world. Waiting for peace in our country. Waiting for peace in our family. And when we know who holds our hearts, and not only does he hold our hearts, he physically, literally gives his heart to us. You individually, not us as a blob, but he knows each one of his sheep. He knows each one of us, and he extends his heart to us over and over and over again. We'll never shove it in our face, never be manipulative, but freely, gratuitously, eternally offering his heart to you and I. And all we need to do is, like Mary, say, I receive. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I still don't get his timing. But the longer we walk with any friend, the longer that we walk with our spouse, the more we know them, the more we know their ways, the more we know their values, their credibility, the more confidence we have. You know, there's great power in great power in nonverbal images. So we were getting ready to make a left-hand turn, and there was this big red sign, and it had an X on it. We knew, don't turn there, it's clear. Based on revelation, on the Bible, on how Jesus has manifested himself, there are a number of well-known images of our Lord that speak of how he reveals his heart. The most common one is the first one, the simplest one, is Jesus pulling aside his garments, that we may see his heart. Pope Benedict said, in the revelation of his heart, God has stepped out of hiddenness. He has exposed himself by the incarnation. He has exposed himself to us. He has become visible to us. The apostles touched him. They leaned against his chest. They knew the smell of his sweat. And they knew the grasp of his hand when they were sinking in the storm. They knew his responsiveness. Lord, we're drowning. It's like, what's your problem? I'm right here among you. Be quiet. And it's like the water became like glass, so still immediately. Another image is one that he's pulled his garments aside and his arms are outstretched. Come to me. Come to me when you're tired. Come to me when you're feeling pious. Come to me when you are tempted with sin. Come to me when you're angry. Come to me when you're a mess. Just come to me. Come to me. And think of it in your own life, how many times you have picked up a child. Whether the child is 2 weeks old, or 10 years old, or 18 years old and just got jilted, all you want to do is put your arms around them and hold them. That desire to give comfort to those who need and want comfort matches God's desire to give comfort. But that's one of those things that you can't receive unless you want to receive it. Like if we're the baby, the kid, the four-year-old that's kicking, biting, throwing things, you think, no, I'm going to let him wear himself out, and then I'll pick him up. There's just not, you can't force it. But Jesus is saying, come, those of you that are tired, those of you that are weary, those of you that are just bored, those of you that are lost and you want to be found, come. Come to me. There's another image that's very common. And Jesus, again, once he has unveiled his heart, he never veils it again. It is unveiled. And you know, we tell people, especially young people, be careful. Be careful. Don't wear your heart on your sleeve. Because you're going to get hurt. Keep it close. Like just tell mom and dad. Or just tell your husband. Don't put your heart out for everybody. Because it will get kicked. Jesus, knowing full well that his heart would be bruised, that it would be pierced, that it would be rejected, is true to himself and who he is as love. So he makes his heart visible. He exposes it for anyone who will receive it. The third common one is he is pointing to his heart. Have you seen that statue or those holy cards where he's pointing to his heart? It's magnificent. Jesus has a human heart. His mother held him in her arms and felt that little heartbeat go. It was a very real, physical, human heart. His heart was also divine. And when you and I talk about our hearts, we're talking about a dual reality. We're talking about an actual organ, the size of my fist. It takes in old, tired, worn out, dark blood, and it does its heart thing. I'm obviously not a cardiologist, but it does a little heart thing. I don't know what it does, but it does something. And then it spurts out clean, fresh, rejuvenated blood. And in the normal heart, this happens 100,000 times a day. With the heart of Jesus, his heart did the same exact thing when he was on this earth. When you and I talk about our hearts, we're talking about a physical heart, and we are also talking about a spiritual dynamism, the capacity to love, the capacity to receive, the capacity to remember, the capacity to be hurt, the capacity to remember the hurt. This is all one heart that you and I bear. And when Jesus is pointing in an image to his heart, he is reminding us that. In his heart, we finally found a place, a way, where we can begin to understand the mysteries of our own heart. When we start to understand the heart of Jesus, and we become aware of the movements of our own heart, I want to make a parenthesis here. In our day and age, we have so much stimulus that it is very easy to get lost and get separated from the movements of my heart. So my heart might be telling me, I am so sad, I am really sad, this loss is really painful to me. It's okay, Sister Regina Marie, just buck up, come on, stand up straight, let's keep on moving. I am missing my own heart. And yet the world tells you, like, be strong, go forward, get it done, knock it off. We've been given a heart that is a mirror of the heart of Jesus. Because we are made in his image. And knowing the movements of our own heart, I'm hungry for God. I am insecure with this relationship. I am driving myself. I'm driving myself, and I don't even know where I'm driving to, and I don't know why I'm driving. But to be able to sit with the movements of our heart helps us hear the heartbeat of Jesus. And you know that, how babies are born, they do this now. And right away they take the baby, if the hospital is willing to do it, they give the baby to the father immediately, because the babies calibrate their heartbeat to the father while the mother is still recovering. How often do we calibrate our hearts to the heart of the Father? And you can say, well, sister, come on, how do you do that? I don't know. You sit quietly and you allow God to hold you. And your heart will be calibrated. And he's very gentle. And it's a way of life. He points to his heart to remind you, I have a heart, I have a human heart. And your heart, your human heart, is where I want to dwell. I don't want to just hold you for a minute and calibrate your heart to mine. I want to do that. That's not just what I want. I want more. I want to live in your heart. I don't want to ever leave you. And think about it in your own lives. If you have a friend, you're a great friend. They go say, come on over, and you come over. And then you never have any contact with them again, what happens? The friendship goes away. It's just what happens. But to be able to ask him, to spend time with him every day, but sister, I'm not a nun. Like, I can't do that. Yeah, you can. Because none of us starve to death. We all find time to eat. We can all find time to simply be with Jesus. In your bedroom, on the couch, in the church, at a retreat, in the garden. He wants you. He wants you to see it. The next image, which is my favorite personal one, but it's the one where he is holding out his heart. That comes from Margaret Mary. Margaret Mary was a visitation nun. She started having apparitions of Jesus, wanting people to understand his heart. And the nuns kind of thought that she was kooky, like a little crazy, but it's okay. She's nice, but she's really crazy. So they called in a Jesuit who was Claude Colombier. Close parentheses, we had his canonizing miracle at our hospital. We had a Jesuit priest. Other hospitals did not want him because the insurance wasn't going to pay him. And we said, no, we don't care. Get him over. He's a priest. We want to take care of him. The holy, holy man had been captured in China. I don't think any of you are old enough, but in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles back in the 50s, every priest prayed a memorare at the end of Mass for the release of Father John Hull from prison. He was in prison and tortured for years in China. Eventually, he was released, and because of it, his lungs were all messed up and his spine was all messed up because of the tortures. So he was with us, and his best friend was a superior, so two Jesuits. The superior got a phone call from the doctor, and the doctor, it was a Friday afternoon, the doctor said to the superior, Father Parrish, I don't think Father Hull is going to make it the evening. And he said, I know, the doctor said, I know he won't make it the weekend. This was a Friday afternoon. And his superior said, thanks for calling, I'll be right there. Hung up the phone, picked it up again, called a woman, want anything done, call a woman. And he said, get the prayer chain going. Father Hull needs prayer now. And we're going to pray through the intercession of Claude de la Colombière, the spiritual director of Margaret Mary, who had never been canonized. So she said, the woman said, okay. And she started the phone call chain. Our sisters were on shifts at different times, so we didn't have the same patient. So we may have a night shift, we may have a morning shift. So this was Friday night. Monday morning, the sister walked in she had orders already written for her to take the x-rays of Father Hull. So she picked up the orders and she pushed down the cart and she took the x-ray and came back, and the radiologist, who was like a brother to her because they had worked together for like 40 years, he got mad at her. He goes, you took the wrong patient. And she said, I did not. And he said, this can't be Father Hull. She said, I spoke to Father Hull. We chatted. And he said, he can't chat. He's comatose. And she said, you go down there and take it again if you want it again. His lungs were pure and full. God is real. And does he give us every miracle we want? Yes. But does he deliver it in the way we want? No. How many times we have prayed for people to be healed and they have died. Oh, but this healing, well, the way they got it, that's eternal healing. It's okay. That heart that Margaret Mary saw, she had to make a decision. Would she allow Jesus really to give her his heart? If I could read all of your consciences right now, my guess is that 99% of us would say, I'm not worthy for that. Like, go give that to the Pope. But that's not true. That is a diabolical lie from the enemy. All the way through this New Testament, all of Paul's major epistles, all of the synoptic gospels, there is a word that runs through every one of them. No one's offering the word. Mystery. Paul is very, very clear about the mystery. We know the mystery. We know what it is. It can be known. It is knowable. It has been revealed. We have seen it. We know what the mystery is. No one is to be denied. This mystery is open and made available to every single human being. Okay, but what is the mystery? The mystery is this. And it's from the very first words of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The Catechism has over 3,000 articles. And the very first word of the very first article sets us on the path of truth. And everything builds from that. And the first word is God. Oh, that relieves me to know Him. I am not the cornerstone. I am not the pillar of the family that needs to hold the tent up. God, not me. God, infinitely perfect in Himself, who is made pure love. I don't know about you, but I don't encounter pure love very often. Maybe it's just because I'm from Los Angeles. The best of what you and I typically get is in friendship. Someone will do something kind for you, and you do something kind for them. You look out for them, they look out for you. There's a relationship that is good, that is benign, unless it's manipulative. I'll do this for you if you do this for me. No, that's manipulative. But that's benign goodness. But His love is without condition. And it is without end. The God who created everything in Himself, everything that exists, everything that is, was created by God in an act of pure love. You can reject me, and I will love you nonetheless, but I will love you. God, infinitely perfect and blessed in Himself, created you. Get out. Say that again. I will. In an act of infinite love, in His freedom, He chose to create you that He might draw close to you. That's the only reason why He made you. He just wants to be near you. He wants to draw you close to His heart. That's the whole thing of Advent. That's the whole thing of I am waking myself up. I am orienting myself to. I am listening. I am expanding my heart. Oh, how do I expand my heart? It's really odd. If you want to expand your heart, you have to get rid of some stuff. Oh, but that seems like it would shrink it. No, there's stuff that's cluttering all of our hearts that shouldn't be there, doesn't need to be there. It's the sin that I committed when I was 16 years old, and I've gone to confession 465,000 times, but it's still there. No, it's not. It's gone. It's gone. If you know this, when Margaret Mary was having all these visions of Jesus in his heart, and the priest that was directing her said, okay, I want you, because he wanted to test her, like, is this not me just dreaming, making stuff up? And he said to her, okay, I'm giving you an assignment. She said, all right, Father, tell me. I want you to go the next time Jesus appears to you. We'll see if it's true. Next time Jesus appears to you, I want you to ask Him to tell you, with my permission, to tell you my last greatest sin. She says, okay, Father. So she goes, and she's in the next time Jesus appeared, she said, Father asked me to ask you this. And Jesus looked at her and said, I have no clue. I don't remember. It's gone. It's been forgiven. It's gone. Why would I hold that? Some of us are very sensitive people, and we can get really hurt easily. And then we have really big memories, and we can remember it. And we can feel it again. And then it grows a little bit bigger. And she really shouldn't have done that. It's already been forgiven. God forgave her. Even if she didn't ask for it, God forgave her. She's just not enjoying the peace from it. Advent tells us, Mary tells us, what's important. What's important? What needs to be decluttered? What needs to be let go of? Mary, of all of us, Mary is the one who had the perfect Christmas. Yeah? Holding that little baby? And through the terror of why she left, babies were slaughtered, she needed to get out of here, and she needed to get registered so that Pontius or whoever he was, the king of the time, could get more money from them. All this intrigue, world disorder, was going on around her. And the Son of God was laid in a manger. So don't worry about it if you don't have all your Christmas decorations up. Take care of your heart. Take care of your awareness of what's going on in your heart. We had in my family a catastrophic, it's a story for another day, but a very catastrophic, traumatic, deadly event in our home. Our family was devastated. We lost my mother, and in 1 minute, the entire family fell apart. And I was the youngest, and I had to hold it together because I'm the girl. And what I saw, what I heard, is what no one ever wants to hear or see. And I didn't know what to do with it. This was a long time ago. We didn't have psychologists. We didn't have good, And then I was living with a bunch of men who really don't get it. And they're not in touch with their heart at all, typically. We need to help them. That's the woman's on-ramp. And I was holding way too much stuff in my body, in my mind, in my heart. Too anger, confusion, responsibility, all kinds of stuff. And I found myself drawn to the book of Job. Wasn't sure why. Now, this is super important. So I would sit on my bed. I was 16 years old at the time. I'd sit on my bed with my legs crossed, and I'd have my Bible. And I wasn't going to be a nun because I was going to be normal. Remember that. And I would, I'm still working hard on being normal. So I would read Job out loud. And somehow it gave me peace because Job fought God. And Job was really angry with God. And he didn't mind telling God and standing up before God and saying that, where are you? I needed you. Why did you do? And God fought back. And God said, you think you're so smart, you little twerp? Tell me, where were you the day that I created the universe? Okay, so the book of Job is a book of wisdom. It's not a historical book. It's a book of wisdom. And I didn't know why I was getting comfort out of reading that out loud. Until years later, I read it again. I went back to it. And Job has three friends. So when he loses all of his children, then he loses all of his crops, and then he loses all of his livestock, he loses everything, and he's mad. And then his three friends come to be with him, and they sit with him in silence for, I forget, 7 days. That's friendship, to be in solidarity with your friend who is brokenhearted, and just to be present. And then at the end, it ends up, God says, okay, you friends, you're done, out, go, no more, ya basta. And you, Job, come here. And he restores everything to him. The moral of the story, when Job, after they had their days of silence, Job's friends were talking to him. And he was saying, I know I'm hurt, it makes me so mad. And the servants were saying, no, God is the Most High, we must praise him always, and we love God, and you must not say that, you must not feel that, you must not think that. The friends were dismissed. They never spoke to God. They spoke beautifully about God, which was true. So don't take my intonations as a mocking of them, because it's not. They were just saying all the lovely things, all the right things, but they never spoke to God. Job did not speak pretty, but Job spoke his heart to God. Go back to the first article of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. He created you for intimacy. He created you to be close to him, to know him, to know his ways, to know what he smells like, to know how he moves. And we can't have, you know this in your own personal relationships, you can't have real intimacy, real trust, unless there's authenticity. If you're only giving the right words because this is the right, it's just because what I've been taught and this is what I know, but there's no heart to it. And all he wants is for you to come, for the real you to come before the real God and allow the real God to love you and to hold you, and to guide you, and to heal you, and to show you new paths, and new ways, and former ways go away. And it's never, ever too late. Ever too late. I want to conclude. You all got a little bookmark, and it's an odd bookmark. And I love this bookmark. It's a great meditation. Let me tell you the story, what it is. I have never been to the Cathedral of Chartres. I probably never will be, but I have heard that this is a very unnoticed sculpture. It's very, very high up. It's not easy. The lady on the back, we have her permission to use it, and her only request was to give her name, you know, that she gets credit for it. She was able to get up, get the equipment, and take this photo. This photo, if you didn't get one, Sister Anita Mary will walk home in punishment because they're all good. But it also tells you, let me finish. So what this is I thought it's usually listed as Christ creating Adam. It's not. It is Christ restoring Adam. Adam made choices. And the consequence of his choices was to be banished from the secure, beautiful, life-giving garden of peace and harmony. And this is the story of Adam turning back to the Father, and Christ is restoring him. Look at the face of Jesus. How anxious does he look? How angry does he look? Such peace, such contentment. Look at his hands. His hands can almost look feminine. They're so gentle, so peaceful. Adam is he's kneeling at the feet of his Savior. He's come back. And the part that's broken by the hand, that is simply it was not created as part of the original sculpture from what you can see. It's too sharp, the edge is too sharp. If it had just been worn down, it would have been a softer. So it's something, an imperfection in the actual granite or cement. Remember this. And you can find more on it if you look up Bishop Eric Varden, his website, fantastic bishop. But he gives a whole meditation on this. And it's a reminder that Jesus waits for each one of us with great peace, with great compassion. And the reason that he created you was for the sole reason that you might enjoy his inner life. Get out. Say that again. I will. He made you so that you can enjoy his inner life of peace and joy and delight and harmony and rest and beauty. And in order to have that happen, he gives you his heart every single time you receive communion. You are receiving the physical heart and blood, body, soul, and divinity of the God who brought all things together in himself. And he wants to bring you together in himself this Advent. Listen to your heart. Listen to his heart. They will start to beat and sink in harmony, in rest. God bless you.